Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to present a personal view, if I might, about how I see food safety. And I'm going to start off with a case study, which is, in fact, the outbreak that I was involved with in 96-97, which the government asked me to look at, to see what lessons could be learnt from it. And this was actually a series of outbreaks, very large. 21 people died, 500 people were infected. About 1,500 people went to hospital, so it had great cost, personal cost, great cost to the health service and to others. And I just want to review a little bit what happened, because it does tell us what we have to do to achieve food safety. This is the church hall at Wishaw. This was one of the most unpleasant parts of the outbreak. 75 people who normally couldn't go to church because they were too frail were invited to a free lunch. They were given steak pie. And this is the seating plan. The black dots indicate where the people who died from E. coli 157 poisoning sat. This was prepared on an ad hoc basis because there was a rumour in Wishaw that if you sat next to the minister, your chance of dying was much higher. And the minister sat halfway down on the left, on the right-hand table, and there was no... obviously no truth in the rumour at all. This demonstrates that this is a particularly unpleasant bug. Mortality is age-related. The under-fives, young children, and people over the age of about 70 have a particularly high mortality, irrespective of their ongoing health. It doesn't matter. One of the ladies who died had a part-time job. She was in her 80s. She walked 2 miles, cleaned her in estate agents, walked back home, got her messages, as they say in Scotland, you know, her shopping. And she was carried off in a couple of days, despite being as tough as old boots. So this is an extremely unpleasant bug. Why did this outbreak happen is, I think, the important point. It happened because the butcher who was selling the steak pie and many other foods which were implicated in the outbreak ran his business in such a way that he contaminated everything in sight. E. coli 157 is carried by cattle in Britain. About 8 or 9% of all cattle carry this organism. It doesn't cause any disease in them. It only causes disease in humans. And occasionally, a contaminated side of beef will come into a butcher's premises. And this cannot be avoided in the sense that one can reduce the risk, but one cannot eliminate it. And my hypothesis was that a heavily contaminated side of beef came in. Because Mr. Barr, the butcher, did not use standard practice, he didn't have colour-coded handles on his knives for handling raw and cooked meats. He had the Henry Ford Model T principle, you know, any colour as long as it's black. This is a police photograph. And his meat factory, where he cut up the raw meat and where he prepared sausages, where he prepared boiled hams, he prepared ready-to-eat foods on these same tables, he was under the misapprehension that the word biodegradable meant bactericidal. And he was cleaning the tables in between these foods with a detergent, which, when we tested it, and the table on the lower part of the slide shows that the minimal inhibitory concentration obtained for this green liquid, we couldn't ascertain whether it killed the organism. In fact, the organism grew in it neat. So, all this illustrated that there's a good deal of ignorance in this particular operation. And I'll come back to the significance of this as I develop my theme. Just remember that this butcher had 40 staff. He was selling to 90 outlets, and he poisoned 500 people through these bad practices. If you could just bear those figures in mind for a few moments. He said he'd been doing what he'd been doing for many years without any difficulty, and that was true, and all his colleagues did the same, and that was true, and some of them still are doing this. One of the reasons why they've got away with it is that this particular organism is, in fact, a new organism. It is a new challenge. And I just want to use E. coli 157 as an example that when we're talking about food poisoning with microbes, we're talking about evolution. We're talking about biological problems. We have different safety issues to deal with from the railways, where they're not talking about a biological challenge. They're not talking necessarily about something coming totally unexpectedly. E. coli 157 first appeared in this country in 1983. The red line shows the instance in Scotland. the blue line in England and Wales and the yellow line in Northern Ireland. And Scotland, at the moment, certainly has a much higher incidence per head of population than anywhere else in the world. And the northeast of Scotland, from whence I come, has the highest incidence in Scotland. So we sit in the world epicentre of E. coli 157. I think all this really shows is that we don't understand why this organism is common in Scotland. We don't understand how it evolved in detail. We don't know where it evolved. Probably, I think my own guess is that the Pampas of Argentina is as good a place as any. We still have many uncertainties about it. We cannot treat the patients who get the complications by any specific measure. All we can do is give them support. All this points to research needed, and this has to be centrally funded research. This is not something that can be put onto industry, for example. So research is needed to understand this organism. If we're going to attempt to control it in the animals, again, we need to do basic research to find out more about its natural history. And another example of this is E. coli 157, fortunately, is rare. We have about 1,500 cases a year recorded in England and Wales, about perhaps 2,000 if we include Scotland and Northern Ireland. Campylobacter is the commonest bacterial cause of food poisoning. We have about 55,000 cases a year recorded in England and Wales, which translates probably to about 500,000 cases when one does the sum and take into account that patients, some don't go see their GPs, some GPs don't take samples, some samples don't result in a positive result, and so on. One aspect of Campylobacter which puzzles us, one among many, is why in about week 23 in the year, in the early summer, is there a massive surge of infections in people. This is 2 years in Scotland, 97, 98, showing this surge repeating itself. We haven't got the vaguest idea why this should happen. We haven't got the vaguest idea where this organism is coming from. We know that if you go to the supermarket and test the chickens in the supermarket, the percentage that will be positive from Campylobacter will vary somewhere between 30 to 100%. And some of the chicken, the Campylobacter on the outside of the wrapper, not just on the inside. But we don't know whether, in fact, that is making a major, a minor, a significant, or what have you, contribution to food poisoning, because we suspect that not all the Campylobacters on chicken are ones that infect people, although we haven't yet got a typing system robust enough to work that out. Sticking with the chicken theme, this has been the cause of many difficulties with food poisoning, in that the chicken industry works, again, on the Henry Ford principle. It's on the mass production scale. You can see these are figures from the United States, that production, a million chickens has gone up. In 1934, it was 34, and it's now 7 billion. The price has come down. The live weight has doubled. The feed rate conversion is very much more efficient. And the per capita consumption, which is a political issue, Herbert Hoover said, in the late 1920s, in his election campaign, a chicken in every pot. That was when the Americans were eating 0.7 pounds per year. And Bill Clinton has been supported very substantially by Don Tyson, who is one of the big, big, big chicken producers in the United States in Arkansas. And they're now consuming 100 times as much chicken in 1994 as they were in 34. This is good news for heart disease. White meat, I think everybody agrees, is much better for you than many other foods. It's bad news from the food poisoning point of view, because if you look at the concentration of the industry, particularly the bottom line, this is the US industry again, so I'm not treading on any UK toes. The top four firms produce 97% of the breeders, and if you get a salmonella into the breeding flocks, clearly the potential for that salmonella just going zapping its way through all the flocks is very great, and in fact, this is what's happened in practice. In fact, a good news story about salmonella in chickens is that industry has decided to do something about it, and industry is now having a massive success in that the percent of chickens positive for salmonella is dropping like a stone, or it has been for the last 3 years, by about 50% a year. We may be soon in the position that the Swedes claim to be in, when they can actually sell chickens that are salmonella-free, which is a major advance. So here is an example of industry, in a sense, doing its bit for food safety by taking the pathogen out of the food altogether. So John mentioned enforcement. I want to spend a little time on that, because that was an issue that came up in the Central Scotland outbreak, that we have a lot of food law. It really starts in Europe, and then it gets modified in this country and so on. It's very complicated. It's a curious branch of criminal law, in a sense, in that it's curious in that the offences are all statutory, and it's not looked after by the police. It's looked after by other people. And there are special defences, such as due diligence, which mean that sometimes you could see it as a little bit soft. But there are very few prosecutions. But enforcement has given major problems, and I'm sure this is something the Food Standards Agency is looking at very well. I think Sir John said it was something that was being looked at very carefully. This was what the sheriff in Scotland said about the deficiencies at Mr. Barr's butcher. He'd been inspected 3 times in the year before the outbreak, and in fact the frequency of inspections had been reduced because the inspector thought that the management system was particularly good. Well, of course, the management system was particularly bad. This is what the sheriff said, that basically he felt that the enforcement that was being done was a nonsense. I'd like to compare that with another enforcement issue, which has curious similarities and parallels. And there's a personal experience. I was woken up in the morning of the 6th of July 1988, because my house is under the flight path of helicopters to Aberdeen Royal Infirmary, about 3 in the morning. And this was the helicopters coming in from the Piper Alpha oil rig, which had just blown up. And Lord Cullen, in his inquiry, made a similar point to the sheriff in the fatal accident inquiry in the 1996 E. coli case, that this had also been inspected 3 times in the previous year, and had been inspected, in fact, 10 days before the oil rig blew up. And the inspector had commented on how the management was coping very well. He said the inspections were superficial to the point of being little use. And that's what happened at the Piper Alpha. You may think that this is an occupational problem. This is for the people working on the oil rig, 165 of them who died. This is when a pipe ruptured, releasing gas under pressure of about 1,700 pounds to the square inch. This is a pipe about 80 feet long running under the oil rig, which had had burning oil dripping on it for about half an hour. And this is what finished off most of the workers who were waiting to be rescued in a module on the platform. What Lord Cullen recommended in his report was that oil companies should take a much more active role in self-regulation. And he said that they should prepare a safety case. He prescribed how this should be done, which was basically they had to look at the hazards, the risks in their operation, say what they were going to do about it, and say how they were going to monitor what they were doing about it, and write it all down. And so John mentioned that hazard analysis, exactly the same. In the food industry, it is exactly the same. You identify the hazards, you identify the critical control points that are controlling, you're going to control those hazards, you say how you're going to monitor them, you say how you're going to do verification, and you write it all down. And I think there's a coming together here of the way we could look at both enforcement and at how we regulate. We're moving now from a more prescriptive era, starting in 1819 with the Factory Acts, to self-regulation, which of course received a big boost with the Health and Safety at Work Act in 1974. It is not easy. This is a slide that I took from a paper by some Canadian nuclear regulators pointing out that George Stephenson was in favour of self-regulation on the railways, and that through the 19th century this didn't work too badly. The Railway Inspectorate published its reports and induced the railways to improve their practices by naming and shaming, essentially. It was very much a self-regulation that the legal system did not come to play very much in this. Seemingly, the railways have a little bit lost their way on that. And I think it does show that it's all very well to push self-regulation, but there clearly has to be a balance between prescription on the one hand and self-regulation on the other. If you read Lord Cullen's report, there's a good deal of prescription in there. as well as the notion of self-regulation. And certainly in my report on the E. coli outbreak in 1997, we had the same dilemma that it's all very well to say the firm has to do a hazard analysis, work out its own salvation. The environmental health officer will come in and see this working and give them a pat on the back if it's working well and so on. In practice, this is very difficult, and there has to be some prescription. And we decided for butchers, small businesses, a prescriptive element was still required, at least for the time being, until better education about food safety had come through. For the larger firms, hazard analysis is already working extremely well. And so what we recommended was a mixture of selective licensing and hazard analysis for butchers. Unlike in south of the border, where hazard analysis was picked alone, so there's an interesting experiment rolling from about the end of this month, where the two systems are going side by side. All butchers to get a license in England have to have a hazard analysis system in place. Butchers in Scotland can choose to have a prescriptive system as well, or hazard analysis if they think they're in that, they're strong enough to do that. This is the size of the business that creates the problems. A small business self-regulation there, I think, has many problems. What we have to do, this is a slide taken from James Reason's book on basically on occupational safety, but I think it applies very well to food safety, that we can have a series of barriers protecting the public from microbes particularly. And what James Reason's, his argument is that failures basically, which are the holes which when they line up, the pathogen can come through, and no system is perfect, so every system has holes. What you want to prevent is the holes aligning themselves. And the aligning can be due either to active failures, when somebody does something under pressure, he knows he shouldn't be doing it, but he still does it, he's sloppy, he's incompetent, or latent conditions are when the management of the firm has not given the appropriate training, provided the appropriate equipment, and so on. So there's a strong management element here involved, which comes through in hazard analysis too. And these are the two things that need doing. It's not a simple question of the old-fashioned type of inspection with walls and ceilings, but looking at the way the firm is managed too. And this is much easier for large firms than small firms, coming back to my point about prescription. What about safety? Sir John mentioned that clearly we're never going to make food completely and absolutely safe, but there are some things about which we get very, very concerned. We get very concerned about E. coli 157 because it has a high mortality, because an outbreak has a very, very strong impact on the public and therefore on politicians. Although the outbreaks are rare, they have this resonance, which means you cannot ignore them. They're also a very useful source of information about food safety. This is botulism, which is the ultimate nasty in food. This is a family, an American family, happy to say, that was poisoned by home carrying in the 1920s. It's a standard textbook picture. We've had very few botulism outbreaks in this country because a lot of attention is paid to the way food is prepared to stop the spores of this organism, which are ubiquitous, surviving in food and killing people. There is still a very high mortality associated with botulism. So although the disease is vanishingly rare, it achieves a deal of attention from the government end as well as from industry. Another one where I suspect industry will have very little role at all is small round structured viruses. These are probably the commonest cause of diarrhea in the community. This is an extract from a recent report from the Advisory Committee on Microbial Safety Foods that Sir John mentioned about this. And this is spread by food. For example, when the chef vomits over the food he's preparing in the kitchen, or there is a well-known case where the chef actually vomited into the sink and washed the sink and then prepared the lettuce and so on in the sink. And this organism is very efficient at transmitting infection. A few virus particles are enough to get you going with your projectile vomiting. And this is very much down to the people working in the kitchen, down to the people working at home. My last two slides, what is the current position on food poisoning? Salmonella, the blue line, the blue line is taking a very satisfactory dip. This is ascribed at the moment to what industry is doing with vaccinating birds, keeping their hen houses clean. But Campylobacter, which is the uppermost line, is not showing any signs of real decline, very difficult organism to cope with. And then there are a whole range of other organisms. E. coli 157 is too rare to figure on this chart. This is purely a microbial analysis of where we stand at the moment. We stand probably 2 million cases of food poisoning a year in the UK, and that is a very, very significant, got a significant amount of guesswork in it. And I'll just finish with some rather rude remarks from Chris Haskins about what we're about and what the food game is about, just to finish on a high note. Thank you very much.